This is KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. I am one of your hosts for today, Susan Franzen, together with civic reporter Dennis Hart, who's my co-host. Hi, Dennis.
Hello, Susan, and hello, everyone. Well, I have a question for you on this Friday. With July 4th behind us, Susan, what is there for the rest of the summer?
You probably know better than I do, since you have compiled a weekly summary of the news from the Ames Tribune. But at the end of the program, we'll have Susan Guiazda reporting for the city of Ames, and I'm sure she'll have a few things to tell us about. In between, we'll hear about interesting and unusual events coming up this weekend and beyond. So you listeners will learn a lot about what's going on if you stay tuned. So what's the news, Dennis?
Well, Susan, let's start with a summary from last Saturday's Ames Tribune, which featured the last of a three-part series about the challenges facing beginning farmers in Iowa and their struggle to survive. Saturday's story by reporter Dan Micah features Ben Barron, who's trying to make a go of it in Jefferson. Saturday's trip also reported that the First Baptist Church in Ames would be celebrating its 150th anniversary last weekend. The church was created during the Civil War by a group of eight settlers before Ames was even founded. The church dissolved but was reorganized back in 1868, and services were held in the back of a harness shop, believe it or not. In 1872, an official building at 5th and Kellogg was constructed to house the congregation, and years later, the church moved to its current location on Lynn Avenue. Saturday's trip also reported that a new summer learning opportunity for students is coming to Ames soon. Starting July 9th, Monday, the so-called Community Academy will let students from preschool through 12th grade take part in two week-long summer education sessions, featuring programming from project-based learning to nature exploration. The program is independent of the Ames School District, and you can learn more about it in last Saturday's Ames Trib. Sunday's trip featured a long takeout on the city of Ames' long and contentious discussion and eventual action on establishing a rental cap in some neighborhoods near Iowa State. That discussion and action took months, as you'll recall, and now the city is trying to figure out how to help so-called hardship homeowners affected by the cap, the ones who cannot sell their homes or who bought them with the intent to rent. Reporter Austin Cannon details how Iowa City and a city in Minnesota installed 30% rental caps on neighborhoods near the universities in their towns. The cap in Ames is 25%, and now some are wondering whether someone's going to go to court to legally challenge it. Also Sunday, the Tribune reported that the Ames City Council has decided to award the South Duff Avenue Improvement Project to an Ames construction firm, even though the company's bid for the project came in more than $500,000 above the city's estimate. Before the council approved that project, city staff said it would try to work with the contractor to save some money by changing the project. Residents of the Southdale neighborhood who live along the stretch of South Duff set for the improvements urged the council not to delay anything and get the project going. The city estimated the project would cost $1.8 million, but the bid came in at $2.4 million. There was more in Sunday's trip, including word that pharmacies across Story County handed out free kits of naloxone, which is an opioid overdose reversal spray, to anyone who walked through their doors last Friday. This giveaway day was designed with hopes of providing a life-saving option for those at risk of opioid overdose. And the Trib reported that work has started on a $14 million project to improve facilities in the Gilbert School District. Last April, voters approved a $14 million bond referendum, which included plans to renovate all four Gilbert District schools, along with athletic and fine art facilities. Now work on the first phase of that project has started, with renovations in the works at both Gilbert Intermediate and the elementary school. $1 million will be spent on this first phase of the project, and the $13 million second phase, that's going to start next summer. As you know, the Trib is not published on Mondays, but on Tuesday, it was warm and sunny around these parts, but the Trib's main stories had to do with flooding. For starters, there was word that state transportation officials planned to close U.S. Highway 30 at the Des Moines River west of Boone yesterday, Thursday morning. Part of that highway was expected to flood because of rain from the north and because of water backup from Sailorville Lake in Polk County, which the river flows into. Officials said then they hoped to reopen the highway next week. Then came word that the highway would close Wednesday, but the latest word now is it likely will not close at all. As you can see, this is a changeable story. Stay tuned. Tuesday's Trib also reported that southeastern parts of Story County were hit hard, very hard, by the storms that dumped 7 to 10 inches of rain from Ankeny to Des Moines last Saturday night. Flash flooding filled homes with water, pushed through hotel lobby windows, and killed one man in Des Moines who was swept away in the current. From Collins and Maxwell up to Nevada, rain inundated ground that was already saturated. That resulted in flooded yards and basements. In Maxwell, storms caused flooding in areas where no one had ever seen water before. In Collins, one man said he had a river, that's how he described it, a river running through his basement. And one more note about the weather. If you thought we had a lot of rain here in Ames last month, you were right. In fact, Tuesday's Tribune reported that we had a record amount of rain for the month of June, officially 12.75 inches of it in June at the municipal airport. But other spots around town posted as much as 14.75 inches of rain. What a year it's been so far. After a brutally cold winter, April was the coldest April ever for Iowa, while May and June were among the warmest. Go figure. There was more in Tuesday's trip, including a reminder that increased parking rates took effect Monday in Ames. Two-hour parking spots now cost $1 an hour. Four-hour parking is now 75 cents an hour, and 10-hour spots cost 50 cents an hour. It's the first parking rate increase in a quarter century, and the city says the money is needed to pay for parking facility upgrades. The rate hikes come with something new. Drivers can now pay, if they want to, by downloading and using the ParkMobile smartphone app, which lets them pay for parking by using a debit or credit card. Of course, you can also pump quarters into it as well, the meter. The Trib also reported that the city council has approved offering a one-time $2,000 bonus to facilitate the hiring of a Cyride mechanic assistant. That position has been open for more than a year, and Cyride embarked on two failed recruiting efforts to fill it. Tuesday's Trib also had word that an Ames man has been charged with operating his boat while intoxicated. That's right, his boat. Court documents show that the propeller on 24-year-old Hunter Christian Wagner's boat sliced a woman's leg at Sailorville Lake last Saturday. Authorities said he admitted putting the boat in gear that caused the propeller to turn and which lacerated a 20-year-old woman's legs. Authorities said he also admitted drinking six beers on that Saturday afternoon. And Tuesday's Trib also had a long feature story on 16-year-old Boone High School student Erica Heckman. She has spent the past 5 years as a rodeo rider from barrel racing to pole bending. She's this year's Iowa High School Rodeo Association queen, and she's earned a position on the Iowa National High School Rodeo Team. And now she's planning to compete at the 70th Annual National High School Finals Rodeo in Rock Springs, Wyoming in 2 weeks. Good luck, Erica. On Wednesday, the 4th of July, the Trib reported that renovations are continuing at Ryman Gardens in Ames. The goal is to transform that beautiful 17-acre site into an even stronger and better-known destination spot. Construction's now underway to develop the south end of the gardens into a new space, which will be called Sycamore Falls. Now listen to this. It's going to feature a cascading water wall, a stream and a reflecting pool, as well as an elevated boardwalk, a shade structure, and a terrace. There will even, be a six-sided tower more than 40 feet tall, which will be lit up at night. And of course, there'll be sycamore trees, seven of them, each of which happens to be 80 years old, even older than I am. Wednesday's Trib also reported on Tuesday's Story County Board of Supervisors meeting where the supervisors heard about recent flooding problems in Kelly caused by a clogged drain. The supervisors also heard about the damage last weekend's rain caused to some of the county's gravel roads. Wednesday's paper also had word of the arrest of a former Ames man wanted in connection with a couple of robberies that took place in Ames 3 years ago. 28-year-old Jeremy Devon McCorley was arrested this past week in Jackson, Mississippi. The Trib also reported that an Ames man who briefly tried to overturn his sexual assault guilty plea last month has once again entered a plea, and he'll be sentenced July 16th. Clarence Castile was arrested a year ago and originally pleaded guilty in April. After that, he tried to overturn that plea by claiming he was not aware of the requirements of the sexual assault registry. And one more note from the Independence Day Tribune. Word that pooches and pups were practicing jumping into a massive pool of water in Ames on Tuesday. That's right, pooches and pups in a pool, in advance of the annual 4th of July dog jumping event near downtown. The event showcases dogs who are trained to follow a toy that's tossed off a ledge through the air and into a pool of water. I wouldn't do that, but maybe my dog would if I had a dog. The headline in Thursday's Tribune said it all. July 4th parade draws thousands in downtown Ames. The Trib estimated that 8,000 people lined the streets of Ames on the 4th. And yes, they watched all the parade marchers and all the vehicles, and they listened to the Ames Municipal Band as band members rolled by on a flatbed. And they watched those pooches and pups jumping into that pool. But many people also came for the annual free pancake breakfast in front of City Hall. Seemingly, a good time was had by all, including me. I was there. It was a fine fourth indeed, and those pancakes were very good. Thursday's trip also had word that the city of Ames is testing a new smartphone reporting app that hopes to roll out in a few weeks. That app is called Ames on the Go, and it will let residents report potholes, damaged signs, and some other repairable public works issues. Now, we're going to talk to an Ames City spokesperson about all this in just a few minutes, right here on this broadcast, so stay tuned. Thursday's trip also reported that the Story County Sheriff's Office has equipped its first vehicle with an AED. Now, that's an automatic external defibrillator. That's a device that can shock a person's heart and restore its functioning in case of a heart attack or other problems. The sheriff's goal is to eventually equip every single one of its vehicles with an AED. That's a good idea. On the crime beat, Thursday's Trib reported that all seven Des Moines men who were accused of robbing Ames partygoers last April now have their trial date set. That date is August 21st. And the Trib reported that the federal trial for the Ames man who was indicted for allegedly mailing an envelope filled with a white powder that was thought to be anthrax has been delayed until July 30th. 66-year-old Mondell V. Olson's trial originally was set to begin this past Monday. Today's Tribune, Fridays, reports that Ames police unfortunately saw an increase in calls about the illegal use of fireworks between July 3rd and yesterday morning. During that time, authorities received 62 calls about fireworks compared to 55 in the same period last year. Fortunately, no one was injured, and police said they issued no citations. Now, even though state law allows the sale and possession of fireworks this time of year, the city of Ames bans setting them off within city limits. Anyone caught violating that ordinance faces a $250 fine, but that didn't seem to stop some people from lighting up those fireworks. Also on the front page of today's Trib, word that no one was hurt, fortunately, after a Fairway grocery store tractor trailer plowed into a stalled semi-truck on I-35 outside Huxley yesterday. That crash closed the northbound inside lane for a couple of hours. The stalled truck did have its emergency flashers on, and its driver had set out warning triangles, and visibility was clear. One more note from Friday's Trib, today's Trib. Argus and Wookie's Pet Shop on Burnett Avenue in Ames has closed just 6 months after it opened. Co-owner Paula Sprague said, in her words, it's a hard decision. It's emotional, but this is how business goes. And that's how a summary of the week's news goes from the pages of the Ames Tribune. And, of course, Susan, I'll be back next Wednesday with a look at what's happening from the pages of papers in nearby communities. So pups were pouncing into a pool off a diving board. And I just don't know if I would do that. Would you do that?
No, I wouldn't. But I used to have I've had some dogs that would jump into any water that they possibly could. So I don't feel that this is pet abuse. I think those dogs loved it.
The only water I like jumping into is a shower in the morning. That feels pretty
well,
good. It's not a deep dive there.
My dogs didn't like the shower so well. But, yeah, but when I was looking for music for today's program, I was anticipating the news that you would have, and I've picked something that I think will be very suitable.
Up in the sky, stormy weather, since my man and I together keeps raining all the time. Life is bare, blue misery everywhere, stormy weather, just can't get my poor self together. I'm weary all the time, the time. So blues walked in and met me If he stays away, oh, rocking chair will get me. All I do is pray the Lord above will let me walk in the sun once more. Can't go on. Everything I had is gone. Stormy weather.
I had to stop when she said, I hope the Lord will let me walk in the sun sometime, because that's what we've got today, is the sun.
Oh, yes. Yes. That, of course, Ella Fitzgerald, the great Ella Fitzgerald, singing Stormy Weather. That's kind of a suitable look back at much of the week's news. In case you just tuned in, where have you been? We've been here for a while. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Hello. We explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Dennis Hart, one of your hosts for today, with Susan Franz. And that was a lovely song, Susan.
We have an event now to talk about coming up next Wednesday. We have another Pantorium session, the 11th, at 7 p.m. Nick Buhlbauer, who will be broadcast live from KHOI. We have more details about that next week and maybe some songs of his. So there's an event at the Octagon across the street from us this next week. And we have Beth Wenninger, the education director of the Octagon, here to tell us about it.
Thank you. We are doing an art camp next week for children ages 7 to 12 called What Does Sound Look Like? And we're going to be focusing on sounds that inspire us to create art, as well as creating instruments, traditional and non-traditional, from all kinds of mixed media supplies that we have collected over the years and some that we're purchasing new. We have lots of interesting things going on in terms of guest speakers and some fun, really fun music that we will be listening to, as well as coming here for a visit with our group. We're very excited to do that as well.
I believe you have an exhibit at the gallery at the Octagon. Could you tell us about that?
Certainly. We have a wonderful exhibit going on in our Sweeney Gallery, which is on the third floor of the Octagon building. It's Alex Braidwood. He's a graphic design professor at Iowa State University in the College of Design, and he also does listening instruments and creating listening instruments with children and adults. The exhibit is all based on sound, so when you come in, the room is very dark and quiet and mysterious, but there's all kinds of natural sounds going on, like birds and observations from outdoors. And it's a really interesting show just to come if you need to get out of the heat and come and enjoy the quiet space and just listen to nature. It's really wonderful.
What is a listening instrument?
It's to be determined. He's going to help us create some listening instruments, but he is going to use wire and paper and tubes, and he's going to help us create something that will make some kind of a sound or a noise, and then have the children draw those images or what that vibration might look like. I'm not exactly sure what it's all going to look like, but there will be sound coming from these materials.
Okay. Well, it's not like a listening instrument like when you used to put a can to your ear and it had a string to another can. It's not that kind of listening instrument.
It's not that I am for sure, but we are going to be doing that in the camp next week, a little old-fashioned, old-school listening instrument, as well as making iPhone speakers out of tubes and cups so kids can learn to listen to music and make things from really inexpensively, make their own listening instruments. So that'll be kind of fun. Toilet paper tubes are great that way.
Yes, that's what they were. not tin cans.
Right.
Thank you. In the spirit of the experiment and the fun of the What Does Sound Look Like camp next week at the Octagon.
Well, that sounds pretty interesting, and we have another event to talk about. It's not going to take place for a while, but it sounds really heavy. Denitrifying bioreactors. Easy for you to say, but not for me. What on earth is that all about, Susan?
We have the best people here to tell about it. Here they are. Gayla Bergman, the Prairie Rivers of Iowa Watershed Coordinator, and Liz Jugums from the Iowa Learning Farm is here to tell us about a bioreactor field day. What's that?
So a denitrifying bioreactor is a fancy word for a wood chip trench that intercepts tile drainage coming from agricultural land, uses natural biological activity with microbes using the carbon from the wood chips as their main food source and respiring with the nitrate coming in with the tile drainage. And as they do so, it releases N2 gas and clean water exits the bioreactor and enters the nearest water body. So it's an edge-of-field conservation practice targeted at reducing nitrate levels in Iowa's waters.
Kayla, so why is Iowa Rivers involved?
In the Iowa watersheds that the nutrient reduction strategy targets, we have excess nutrients from activity in agriculture and activity in the cities and rural areas. So these practices are designed to help mitigate excess nutrients we have in our current water bodies.
And how effective are they?
According to the Iowa Nutrient Reduction Strategy, bioreactors are incredibly effective in reducing nitrate losses, up to 43% of reduction from what comes in via the tile to what's coming out the other end. So the overall goals for the Iowa Nutrient Reduction Strategy when it comes to nitrate from non-point solution is about 41%. So bioreactors are one of the major tools that's going to be needed to be implemented at a relatively large scale across the state of Iowa to help us reach those goals.
Are there any problems with, say, finding the trenches in the appropriate places?
So one of the challenges for bioreactors is that they can treat only about 80 to 120 acres. But the good news is that they can easily be placed in existing buffers or field edges because they don't take any land out of production for the producer because they can fit into those edge of field places. So they can take an existing grassed buffer, dig in the trench. They'll intercept the tile drainage, install the control structures, and the tile will continue out from the field. So in terms of management from an agricultural producer's perspective, there's relatively little to no management once the bioreactor is installed, at least for the first 15 to 20 years, while the carbon is still very active from those wood chips.
What are you going to be teaching people during the field day?
So the field day kind of starts with an overview of water quality issues and some of these tools as solutions, so the bioreactors being one of them. And Iowa Learning Farms has this awesome trailer that demonstrates what's going on under the ground. So they actually have the model of what a bioreactor would look like and some graphics that describes the process of denitrification. And then we'll actually be going to a field to look at a bioreactor. So on top, it just is planted in grass or perennial plants of some sort. So it's not that exciting besides the control structures, but there will actually be an engineer that designs these bioreactors at the field day, and he's going to talk through all of that. And also something very exciting is we have a landowner that has a bioreactor in the Squaw Creek watershed, and he's coming to talk about that process and talk about why he feels it's important that some of these landowners in the watershed think about installing bioreactors.
Field day is about 2 hours. It's going to start at the Field Extension Education Lab, FEEL for short, just outside of Ames, near the Agricultural Engineering and Agronomy Research Farm, just off Highway 30. And it's going to start at 5 o'clock with registration, and we'll kick off the program shortly after, and it'll conclude with a complimentary meal.
What time did you say?
5 p.m.
Oh, 5 p.m., so it's in the evening.
It is in the evening. So if you're working during the day, feel free to come on out. We'll catch you up as soon as you can get there. And we'll first take a look at the trailer that Kayla mentioned, featuring those above-ground examples of what they're going to see as we travel to the field site to take a look at that bioreactor that's been installed. And then, as I mentioned, we'll conclude with a complimentary meal. RSVPs no later than the 16th to make sure that we can contact our caterer and have enough food present.
You can RSVP by calling 515-232-0048, or you can go to our website, Prairie Rivers of Iowa. You can Google that, or prrcd.org is our website, and our field day information is on there. My email is on there, so you can just shoot me an email if you would prefer that method.
And that information will be on our website also. Well, why should people who are not farmers be interested in this technology?
So as a watershed coordinator, I'm tasked with bringing the watershed community together. So we all live in a watershed, whether you are an ag producer or whether you live in the city. So bringing everyone together to the solution table, this bioreactor is a tool in the solution of better water quality for our streams and rivers. So, you know, those people that aren't ag producers or landowners, I would encourage them to get educated on these solutions and also come and learn and communicate with the people in their watershed community. So we think of ourselves in, you know, living in a city or a county or a state, but we have to shift our mindset to watersheds. We all live in a watershed, and it's important for the urban citizens to communicate with the ag producers. You know, we need to sit at the same table because we're all affecting the same water.
Yeah, affecting the same water and being affected by it.
Yeah, as of recent, we are being affected by water as well.
And the interesting thing about bioreactors and other edge-of-field practices is that typically there's no direct advantage or impact to the landowner for putting it in, because it is after it leaves their property. So the true benefit of that practice is to downstream users of that water. So in that case, having that watershed approach where we bring in all components and residents of that watershed can help us better understand how these practices are implemented, and then also how are we going to get them implemented from a cost perspective. So a lot of these practices are relatively expensive up front, but through what we call cost share, so this would be state or federal dollars that are available through applications to these landowners to install them, our tax dollars are helping promote the installation of these processes as well. So from a community standpoint, if you want to know where some of your tax dollars are going to support conservation, education, and outreach, you can come to one of these field days to learn more about the practices. And if you're a landowner, especially, you know, maybe two or three generations removed, you've moved to town, knowing how to effectively talk to your tenant and bring up some of these practices and even start that conversation of how you want your land managed is a real advantage for everyone to attend a field day in their area, whether they're actively farming or not.
One of the questions that I had is your organization, Iowa Learning Farms, where is that located?
We're housed on campus in the Agricultural and Biosystems Engineering Department at Iowa State University, and we've been around since 2004, so we're really excited to be continuing this effort and these projects with Prairie Rivers of Iowa and other watershed projects to promote conservation, implementation, and outreach, whether that's through doing research ourselves with farmers and our research farms, developing publication materials, and partnering and hosting field days for people to get a chance to interact with researchers that are looking at these practices, but also then farmers and landowners that have implemented them so they can learn directly from a source that's using that practice.
Well, one of the questions that occurs to a lot of people who have been following, for example, the defunding of the Leopold Center, is where does money like this come from? Where do you get your money?
So Iowa Learning Farms is a collaboration of many of our funders, including the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture. They've been a long supporter of our program, but also the Iowa Department of Ag and Land Stewardship, Iowa State University Extension and Outreach, Iowa Natural Resource Conservation Service, the Iowa DNR, and we also strongly partner with many watershed groups and Practical Farmers of Iowa to conduct this research so that we can go out and share these results with farmers based on the questions they're asking us.
A similar question for you, Kayla. What's Prairie Rivers of Iowa, and how did this come about, and where do they get their money?
Yeah, absolutely. So Prairie Rivers of Iowa is a 501c3 not-for-profit. We're located here in Ames. We were founded in 1999 and work under the mission of promoting economic development through restoration of our cultural and natural resources in Iowa. So we have a few programs, including this watershed program, that really connects Iowans to natural resources. So we've actually been working on watersheds since our inception, doing a variety of projects in our central Iowa watersheds. So we sort of have a statewide touch with some of our programs, and our watersheds program, we're really focused on the South Skunk River watershed. So, you know, through education and through demonstration, working with the landowners and working with the urban citizens to come together, like I said, to be a part of this watershed community and positively impact our water quality. And we are funded by a series of grants and contracts. So working with the Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship here in Iowa, as well as Iowa Learning Farms, does. And we also work with the Natural Resources Conservation Service. They have some grants that we work under. And then we also have a project with the Iowa Department of Transportation, the Iowa DOT, for the Lincoln Highway Heritage Byway program we have.
Since you're talking about watersheds, one of the important aspects of watersheds that people are probably aware of right now is flooding. And I've been told that a lot of the flooding that we're getting is because of changes in the watershed practices upstream. Even though that's not quite your area, could you tell us a little about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we are focused mainly on water quality, but water quantity is a huge issue in Squaw Creek watershed, especially recently. And so over time, as we've developed Iowa, we've changed the landscape. So we used to have a lot of holding areas, so they are called prairie potholes. We live in the Des Moines Lobe region of Iowa, so this is poorly drained and the soils just want to hold the water in some of those areas called wetlands. And over time, we've drained those so that we can farm. We have amazing soil in Iowa, very rich and productive soil, and we should be using that to grow crops. So those changes over time have just affected the quantity of water that's coming through compared to what it would naturally do and sit in those areas and infiltrate through the soil. We've actually artificially drained a lot of that, so it's just coming faster, and then we just have increased rain events in some of these times that affect that.
But I have heard that there are ways that agriculture affects mm-hmm. that, even, you know, after the prairie potholes are dredged, that, for example, certain soils hold the water much better. So can you say anything about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Some of the soils do hold the water a lot better than others.
What contributes to that besides the natural richness of the soil?
Organic matter has a lot to do with the ability of that soil to hold on to water as well. So when we can encourage that water to soak in, so having good pore space through no tillage or limited tillage operations that destroy that soil structure, increasing soil organic matter can help store that water and keep it in place instead of sending it across the surface, which will often encourage soil erosion, which can be a secondary challenge of some of these intense rainstorm events in addition to the flooding. And so there's, as Kayla mentioned, been a lot of land use changes over the entire state. It's one of the most altered landscapes in the entire world, whether it's our agricultural landscape as well as our urban landscapes. When we cover more of the landscape with impervious surfaces like concrete or asphalt, we're giving nowhere for that water to go but a storm drain. And so if we can implement a variety of conservation practices that encourage, you know, the building of soil organic matter and soil structure like no-till or strip-till with cover crops. I know City of Ames just redid their parking lot, so they put in some permeable pavers to help encourage that water to soak in. Those can have a big impact, especially with these recent flash flooding events where we've gotten a lot of rain in a short amount of time. Those seem to be more and more frequent and are providing a new challenge not only for our agricultural producers but our municipalities as well.
That's why everybody should care about.
Absolutely. But if you are able to attend on July 17th from 5 to 7 at the Field Extension Education Laboratory in Boone, please RSVP so we know how many people are coming and so we can get enough meals for everyone. Again, our number is 515-232-0048. And you can just ask for Kayla and say that you're RSVPing for a field day.
Thank you.
This is KHOI Community Radio, and you've been listening to Kayla Bergman, the Prairie Rivers of Iowa Watershed Coordinator, and Liz Jukums, the Iowa Learning Farms Watershed Coordinator, telling us about the denitrifying bioreactor field day, a mouthful, but great to know. We've had several programs on the Skunk River watershed or the watersheds of its tributaries, but this is the first time we've talked about solutions to cleaning up the water and preventing flooding. I wonder how long it's going to take for us to make the changes that will truly make a difference.
Our next guest, who I interviewed after the Wild Iowa Discovery, had some suggestions. Facing the likelihood wilderness is something we can never again find in Iowa. The question is what we can do to experience wildness in our surroundings. Our next exploration springs from the Wild Iowa Discovery Conference we talked about last week. After that conference, I interviewed one of the organizers, Roger Ross Gipple, who described Ames, Iowa as ground zero for wildness. I found that a pretty shocking statement, so I asked one of the other participants in the conference, Fred Kirschenmann, distinguished fellow of the Leopold Center, what he thought of that idea. So do you agree with Roger's dramatic statement that Ames is ground zero for wildness?
Well, you could certainly make a case for that, and you can make a case probably for most of Iowa, not just Ames. I think it's part of a larger cultural problem that we have, and it really goes back to when we white Europeans first came to this Western Hemisphere, starting in 1492, and even the Puritans, when they came to the Northeast, they figured that God had brought them here because the Native Americans didn't use the resources that were here, and they referred to the wilderness as the devil's playground, and you needed to drive the devil out and turn that into agriculture and food production, etc. So we have a long cultural history in our country that I think drives us to a point where we not only marginalize wilderness, but we actually see it as somehow getting in the way.
What about Roger's definition of wild? He starts with what Thoreau said about wild being infinite, while wilderness is finite.
You know, the other thing I think that's really important here, and we are beginning to see some resources now that, one of the most recent books that E.O. Wilson has published came out just last year called Half Earth. And, of course, he's 88 years old now, so this is, some of my colleagues think this is going to be his last book. But whether it is or not, he has spent his whole life researching how we can retain the health of our ecological resources, which, as we all know, are at the foundation of all of life for us. And in Half Earth, he has now come to the conclusion, based on a lifetime of study, that we really have to keep half of planet Earth in wildness if we want to see the kind of renewing capacity which makes the Earth a place where we humans can thrive in. So, there are these kinds of insights now that are coming to us. And the reason that I think that Wilson's half-Earth concept is so important is because I think usually when we have some of our environmentalists talk about the importance of wildness, it's like we have a responsibility to do this, and so it's like an obligation that we have to do. And what Wilson is saying now is, look, if you humans want to continue to have a thriving life on the planet, half of the Earth has to be in wildness. So it's to your benefit to do that. It's not just an obligation. It's if you're, want to see a thriving life for your children and your grandchildren and even yourself as you get older, then you have to keep half of the Earth in wilderness.
In Iowa, how would we do that?
Well, that's a really good question, and there are some places in Iowa, and I happen to have the good fortune of being on the board for White Rock Conservancy, and there's 5,000 acres there in southwest Iowa, half of which you can easily say is wildness, and we really are now, and the Garst family has been behind this, really trying to make this a demonstration place that you can have wildness and agriculture together if you manage them in the right way, and it can be pleasant, and it can be thriving, and it can be productive. I think those are some of the kinds of things that we need to feature and make more available to people. And then the other thing that I think is important in all of this is the role that the arts play. And, you know, we still operate in a culture that thinks that everything is about, you know, science, technology, engineering, and math. In other words, we have to figure out how we control things and how we develop the technologies to force nature to be what we want it to be. But in point of fact, the arts is what help us to imagine better, you know, to see ourselves in a new world and how that, to imagine how that will benefit us. And so I think there is some of that is, you know, is beginning to happen. In fact, again, if you go back to Ames, Iowa, one of the faculty members in the English department at the Iowa State University, and she's retired now, but before she retired, she started a program called Ag Arts, in which she recognized that the role of the arts in terms of how we saw agriculture was increasingly important. And that concept has now taken off. And it isn't just at Iowa State University anymore. It's not only throughout Iowa, but even other states have developed ag arts compatible communities of people who are recognizing that the arts have an important role to play as we imagine a new kind of agriculture. And certainly, you know, for most of the people involved in that, that I know at least, they see the you know, wildness as being a part of that future.
Is there anything else that you think is important in bringing this about?
The other thing, again, if you and again, this I'm not trying to say that Roger was wrong in saying that Ames is ground zero for wildness, because in terms of the larger culture, that's certainly true. But anyway, also, I always try to look for a little bit of the good news in terms of, you know, directions we really need to go in. And one of the things, and this may seem a little self-serving because the Leopold Center provided some of the major funding for this project, but again, it came from faculty members at Iowa State University, and they came up with this concept which they called the prairie strips. And they came up with the idea that if we could engage farmers in a way that they would devote 10% of acreage of like corn and soybeans into a prairie strip. In other words, planting 10% of that acreage into perennial grasses, that could have significant benefits. And so the research was done, and what the research demonstrated was, first of all, that, you know, you would think that if you devote 10% of, you know, 100-acre field of corn, so you have, you know, 10 acres of that, that you would have in prairie, that you would actually lose income from that because you wouldn't be able to harvest corn from that. But what they discovered in the research was that because of the edge effect, you actually increase the yields on the edges of these prairie strips. You don't really lose that much in terms of yield, but also that with those prairie strips, you start to have more pollinators and other kinds of that benefits the whole region. And so there are actually a few farmers now that have done this in Iowa, and it's still a very, very small thing, and it's not a certainly not a movement or anything yet, but I think it has the potential to shape part of our future. Well, the other thing that I think we're going to have to face, and we're increasingly seeing this now, is our water quality issues. And the other thing that the Prairie Strips Project demonstrated, that when you have 10%, and usually, you know, you're going to have these prairie strips on the edge of stream banks, et cetera, and that then reduces the amount of pollutants that you have going into the water. And so in the long term, it can at least make a significant contribution to that problem. And that's a problem that we're all going to have to face because, you know, if we can't even drink the water from our own wells anymore, then that's a cost to everybody that we're going to have to deal with.
Well, thank you. I think that there's a lot to think about in your response to Roger's challenge.
Okay. Well, I hope it's useful.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Bye, Fred.
Bye, sure.
This is KHOI Community Radio, and our recent guest, have been talking about the area beyond Ames. It's time now to find out what will be happening in Ames this month. And we have Susan Guiazda from the City of Ames to update us. Thanks for coming in today, Susan.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
What do you got coming up? What's new?
Well, as you all know, July is going to be a really busy month in Ames. Mm-hmm. We have some big events coming. I hope people are aware that we are an overnight stay for RAGBRAI this year. It's been 10 years since the Register's annual Great Bike Ride Across Iowa has shown up in Ames, but they're back. And I want everybody to mark Tuesday, July 24th on their calendar, because whether you're a bicyclist or an enthusiast or somebody who wants to get out of town that day, you need to know what's going on. We've already gotten people calling. They've forgotten what day it is. Is today the day that RAGBRAI comes? I hope that there are no questions on what day RAGBRAI comes, Tuesday, July 24th, and it will be a busy one. So much going on. This ride brings in 20,000 riders, plus the support vehicles and people who just come to see the event. We have a lot of people who just like to welcome the riders when they come in, families that gather along the route, high-five the bicyclists as they come into Ames, cheer them on. It's really a great vibe, a great feeling. But if you're trying to get around town, there are some things you should be aware of. It will be difficult.
And you need a lot of volunteers to help out, don't you?
Absolutely. So this will be a community-wide event, a community-wide effort. In addition to sort of being aware of how difficult it might be to get around town, we need a lot of support in helping us pull this event off. The best way to find out about how we can use volunteers is to check out the AmesRAGBRAI.com website. And there are so many places that we need people at intersections to make sure people are safe, in information areas, to host riders, to be down by the entertainment right close to our studio here. Ames Main Street will serve as the entertainment hub that night. So lots of things going on, and we need so many people to help. I think we said over 1,000 volunteers are needed to pull this event off, and I don't think we're at that number.
Well, you need $9.98 because my wife and I have signed up, and it's easy to sign up.
Well, that is awesome. We need everybody to kind of pull together. You know, there are lots of different jobs, a lot of different tasks. As we said, there are riders who have requested home visits or home stays. So if you're somebody that's thought about maybe offering your yard and your bathroom facilities, it's a great way to welcome people into the community, provide them a little bit more of a comfortable stay than a tent. And then they're off the next morning. They're on their way on that Wednesday, the 25th. They're gone. Just a reminder of that route. As you know, the bicyclists will come in from the west. They'll be coming from Boone, and they'll come up South Dakota. They'll be coming north on South Dakota to Mortensen Road. And then they'll travel down Mortensen Road past the middle school on their way to really the campus area. They'll drive on – they won't drive. They'll bicycle on Mortensen Road all the way down to Beach. They'll take a turn to the north on Beach or a left, and they'll get to South 4th. Their ultimate goal there is to get to Jack Trice Stadium, where they'll be doing the Cyclone Loop. This is a rare opportunity. I don't know that it's ever been offered for bicyclists to do a little loop around Jack Trice Stadium on their bicycle. And it's really going to be a fun event. We'll welcome the bicyclists on South 4th. It's the general gathering spot, and then the bicyclists will disperse for their campsites, for their homestays, to see friends. We anticipate a lot of riders will know people in Ames, and we'll kind of see them disperse all over town. Those that are camping will sort of head to Stuart Smith, some of the fields around Jack Trice, and all the way up to Brookside Park.
We should just assume it's going to be hectic during that day.
It really is. And all I can say to people is just slow down, take some time, just assume it's going to take you longer to get across town, and be patient. It's just going to be busy, and you know, and it'll be fast, and then the next morning they're gone. So for one day, we just appreciate everybody's patience and really rolling out the red carpet for these bicyclists. This is a really awesome opportunity to showcase our community. These are not necessarily Ames residents who are biking. They aren't necessarily Iowans. There are bicyclists from all over the world that come on this event, and they've never been to Ames, Iowa before. And here's a chance for us to show all these people what a great, friendly town this is. And so we've always done a great job. I was here in 2008. I don't know if either of you remember 2008 when they came through. It was fabulous, but it was exhausting.
Yeah. Well, that's not all you've got coming up.
Oh, no. We have right after those bicyclists leave on Wednesday, we're prepping for another event. I hope you remember Rummage Rampage. This is our community-wide garage sale held at the Ames Intermodal Facility. That's the parking ramp on Hayward, 129 Hayward, starting on Friday, July 27th, we'll start taking donations for this event. Like I said, this is the third year, and we're asking the community to donate furniture, housewares, items that they no longer need for and students. We are asking students not to drop all that stuff at the curb. If you don't want that futon any longer, or that dresser just isn't going to be able to travel with you, bring it to Rummage Rampage, and we are going to sell it to somebody who does need it. We generated $14,000 last year, which we then dispersed to the volunteer organizations that helped staff this event. It was a win-win situation for everybody. It really was great. We diverted 20 tons of furniture and debris from the landfill back into the community, because a lot of times that perfectly good stuff ends up in the garbage. It doesn't need to go there.
Very briefly, we mentioned earlier in this broadcast that you're testing an Ames On The Go reporting app for certain things. Can you talk about that briefly?
Yeah. So one of the quick ways that communities have started communicating with their constituents is through apps. A lot of people have smartphones anymore. It's how they're used to talking. And so we are getting on that bandwagon, and we'll have an app in the App Store called Ames On The Go. You download it, and you are able to use it. Say you're walking down the street and you see a stop sign that's down, something that's been vandalized, a big pothole, take a picture, send it in, or just send us a message. Right now we're going to use that for public works types of concerns. So those would be your infrastructure concerns, your street concerns. You see, for example, a stormwater intake filled with debris or branches. Well, that's not good. So you let us know where it is. And if you take a picture, it's geocoded, so we'll know. And you send it to us, and it'll be tracked. That concern will be tracked, and you'll get some status updates on it. And we'll get that information very quickly, and it'll be routed within our own organization to the right people. We're going to kind of test it the next few weeks, make sure we have all the bugs out of it. And then in the future, we see that expanding to maybe a street light's out. Maybe there's an electric outage. Right now, it's public works, but we're hoping that we can expand it to other departments. Ames Public Library has their big summer book sale, which actually starts today. That's Friday, July 6th from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Free admission today. Saturday, July 7th, 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Free admission. And Sunday, July 8th, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m.
Just remember, Susan, I want the Michael Connellys. Okay, I want that Harry Bosch series. You can't get that.
Yes. Okay, you've got it.
I don't think there are any reservations there. No. You just have to go in there.
I'm heading right after the show.
Okay, is there anything else that we can't hold until later?
Well, just again, if you need information about the City of Ames, please go to our website, cityofames.org. We have the latest and greatest there. Please follow us on Facebook. We're on Twitter, and we're on Instagram. Always the best way to get your information. It's quick and it's timely, and we want you to stay informed.
Thank you. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Dennis Hart and I, Susan Franzen, have been your hosts for today. Other voices you heard were just now Susan Guiasta, Beth Winninger, Kayla Bergman, Liz Junkums, Fred Kirschenman.
And you can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That is khoifm.org. There you can also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. That's khoifm.org.
Local Talk was engineered by Cynthia McClure. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Stormy Weather by Ella Fitzgerald.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you'd like to join the team as a reporter, and we would love to have you, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878. Or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. That's also what you need to know to contact us if you decide to become a member or renew your membership today. Just look for that yellow donate button.
If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI meaningful and possible. Thanks for listening, and
see you again on the radio.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. The Ames Main Street Farmers Market brings local food and fun every Saturday, located between the 300 and 400 blocks of Main Street, including Tom Evans Plaza. The Farmers Market brings fresh local fruits, veggies, meats, breads, handcrafted goods, live music, and family entertainment.